Tonight on Arena, a new book on the life and work of poet John Montagu, and poetry and textiles come together in an exhibition called Roots. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can follow us on RTE, or you can watch us, that is, on rte.ie/arena. With me in studio this evening is art historian and critic Jess Fahey, who has been visiting some of the exhibitions currently on show in Dublin. One in the Coach House Gallery in Dublin Castle takes as its inspiration the poetry of Jane Clark, a poet who has been guest on this programme many times and who is inspired by the natural world around her in her Wicklow home. This is an exhibition of textiles, an ancient connection between the words and textiles that reach back to the roots of language, both text and textile, of course, coming from the Latin word texere, meaning weave, write, or tell a story. And the title of the exhibition is based on the poem of the same name, Roots, by Jane Clark. Delighted to have Jane join us on the line this evening. We'll talk with her in a moment. Jess is here in studio with me and Jane is joining us on the line. We'll talk to Jess in a moment. But since Jane is there and since this exhibition is actually inspired by your poem, Roots, you might read that poem for us, Jane.
Okay, thanks, Sean. I'll start with that poem. Roots. 3.5 hours cross country, from shallow limestone lakes to quarries carved in granite. 3.5 hours to loosen the threads that sew me to my mother. One last bend and I'm home. Fruit-scented hydrangea tumbles out over the pillars at the gate. A mass of lace caps, creamy white as milk strained into a basin. My mother taught me how to tie tendrils to the trellis, not too tight. Once the roots are secure, the vines weave up the wall, spreading in every direction.
That's Jane Clark reading her poem, Roots, the poem that is part of the inspiration for an exhibition that we're going to talk about in a moment with Jess Fahey. But excuse me, Jane. To you, first of all, what happened first here? Did the collective come to you and ask about the poetry, or did the poetry arise as a result of this connection with the association with the collective, the textile collective, the arts collective?
Yeah, no, the artists approached me, Sean, back in February in 2023. I got a phone call just asking me would I be open to this group of 15 women artists, mostly based in County Kildare, would I be open to them responding to my work and making an exhibition together? So I was thrilled and really open to it from the start. And so they've been working on it for 18 months.
And in terms of the poem that we just heard, I mean, the words that suddenly jump out at you when you hear where it's played, that it is the inspiration in many ways for the title of the exhibition, the threads that sew me to my mother, the lace caps, how to tie tendrils to the trellis, the latter one, not exactly weaving, but those references to some of the actions of textiles and of textile making. Very interesting that they exist within the poem itself as well.
Well, it is actually. And I suppose one of the things I have always been interested in writing about craft, using craft metaphors as a way of writing whatever it is I wanted to explore. So I think that's, I think that is an interesting connection with the work of the women. But that poem, actually, I brought to a workshop where we were going to all of us speak about our process of creating. So it was my most recent poem. So that's why then that became an important poem for the whole exhibition.
Yeah, yeah. And Jess Fahey, as I say, is with us in studio here, Jane. Jane mentioning there, Jess, that association with craft and perhaps textiles has often been treated not quite as serious art because of that association with craft, and often just maybe dismissed as craft and nothing more, whatever that actually means, nothing more.
Absolutely. It really isn't until the 20th century where you have artists like Sonia Delaunay, who uses a kind of comparison between making a patchwork quilt to cubist works. And then later, and sort of Bauhaus artists like Annie Albers, who uses weaving to create abstract forms. But even with that, those artists were always seen as secondary, even at that time. In the 19th century, you have people like William Morris who tried to suggest that handmade crafts, including textiles, should be on an equal footing with the high arts, which would usually be considered sculpture and painting. And it's a slow process, but I have to say there is quite an exciting movement in contemporary art now where textile art is finally being given so much more attention. And this just isn't in Ireland, but actually across the world, which is a wonderful thing to finally see.
Yeah, and what we get in this exhibition, I think, is it's 39 poems inspiring 41 different pieces. Is that it?
Or
is
it close enough? Other way around.
The other way around.
31 poems, 49 paintings.
Yeah,
or
that
49
would make sense,
artworks.
Yes.
Yeah.
Otherwise, there would be two lonely poems just up on the wall, but all by themselves.
Exactly. Some of the artists respond to the same poems as well. The artist Barbara Seary has a piece on roots where it looks like a kind of stitched piece that makes you think of the way that you tie plants to a trellis. So it works really quite like an illustration in that case. In some of the other cases, it's much less obvious what those links or those connections are. And it's a fascinating thing that the visitor to the exhibition gets to do, because you get to read the poem next to the artwork and then you get to make your sort of interpretation or your analysis, or say, God, I wouldn't have thought it meant that, or I would have looked at it a different way.
And Jane Clark, you went in to visit the exhibition itself in the coach house. Did you see the poems in a whole new light when you saw them in the midst of this smorgasbord of visual art?
Well, it was quite overwhelming, John. I mean, it is stunning. I think it's a really beautiful exhibition. But it's also very moving, because I think the women's work touches into very deep emotions. And then with the poem beside it, and there's also a sound installation, I'm reading the poems through the exhibition as well. So altogether, it's a very powerful experience being there for me. But I know that the visitors are saying that as well.
And Colleen Prenderville's piece, The Gathering Jest, this is more a reaction to us rather than to a specific poem. Is it more about a reaction to poetry and to Jane's poems in general?
It does seem to be, all right. And actually, I had the pleasure of meeting the artist, Colleen Prenderville, as well. So looking at something like this, what I was struck with is that it feels like a little box of keepsakes that might just have meaning to an individual.
I'll tweet the image, actually, of it at RTE Arena. And maybe you describe it to us as you're speaking,
yes.
Jane.
So it's like it's like a little white box with little sections within it, sort of boxed off areas. Again, kind of like a museum exhibit or like a cabinet of curiosities sort of display. And in each of the little sections, there's different pieces made by the artist. But at first glance, you think you're going to know what each thing is. But the more you look, actually, the less clear it is. And it made me think about how in visual language, you can have this correlation to poetry, where the more vague it is, or the less descriptive or prescriptive it is, the more open then for interpretation and meaning it is. And this artwork, I think, functions in a very similar way.
And Jane, I think you had some contact from Colleen Prenderville about how she had responded to your work and fed specifically into this piece.
Yes, well, Colleen was saying that, you know, all of the poems were very powerfully emotive for her, and remembering things about, particularly her father had grown up on a small farm in Cavan, and so some of the details I had in the poem, brought her back there, and it allowed her to express and explore things that she hadn't done in her work before.
And amazing again, that kind of. When you see a response, a visual response to a verbal impulse, I suppose, what is the effect on you in terms of specific pieces? Maybe if we talk about Against the Flow, if we hear your poem Against the Flow, first of all, Jane, if you feel it needs an introduction, you can give it. But I think in many ways we'll know what it's about when you read it.
Yes, Against the Flow. One day you knew you must turn, begin to swim against the current, leave the estuary waters brackish with sediment, head upstream through riffles and deeps, mill races that churn in fate over sheets of granite across weirs, into rapids that thunder pound, squeeze between boulders to the upper reaches of the river, those waters of blanket bog brown, where you'd find a place in gravel and silt to hollow a dip, to spawn a life of your own.
And that's Jane Clark reading her poem Against the Flow, which is part of this exhibition that we're speaking about tonight, that's currently running at the in Dublin Castle at the Coach House Gallery. In many ways, Jane, every poem, of course, is an incredibly personal expression, but I think this one is perhaps more personal than many of your other poems.
Yes, well, I'm using the image of the salmon, of course, going up winter. But yeah, it's a poem about coming out for me. That's what it's about for me. But what's really interesting is that, you know, for the artist who chose the poem, that it's not that at all for her. It's a very different kind of emotional reaction she had. But it's that thing of, you know, that moment in life when you know you have to go take a different road. And it's often a difficult thing to do, but often also the thing that makes all the difference in your life.
Yeah, difficult, but possibly the only thing you can do at that particular moment in time. Elaine Pedden, Jess, is the artist who has responded to Against the Flow of the poem. Again, we'll tweet the image here at RTE Arena. Will you describe it to us?
Yeah, it's one of the ones that really struck me. And actually, I saw the image before I read the text. And looking at the image, I thought it was just an abstract piece. And it wasn't necessarily, you know, referencing anything in particular in terms of just being about an exploration of colour. And then I read the text next to it, and all of a sudden it sort of came to life for me. And you could kind of see that these it's sort of moulded kind of felt material. You could see that the red through it has this sort of representation of life or life force, or even more literally the spawning. And then there's kind of a slimy green over these granite greys. And as you compare that then to the poem, just from a very, you know, straightforward interpretation, different from the one that Jane was giving us, it makes so much sense. And you can start to see how artists can use this sort of creativity of their own just to zoom in on one little thing that appeals to them, or one way of trying to express it. And then again, that's also just my interpretation.
Yeah.
You could also talk to the artist, who will say it's something else, you know, maybe entirely.
Well, that's the
joy. This is the fun of this exhibition, is that it brings all of those things together. And, you know, for me, choosing which ones I wanted to talk about, I had a terribly difficult time. And it was, like Jane said, the ones I was sort of emotionally or visually drawn to, and various different things came up too in terms of my process of how I enjoy art or enjoy poetry. And I think that experience is there for everyone.
And finally, just before I let you go, Jane, we're going to speak some about some other exhibitions with Jess. But before I let you go, I mean, the presumption, and often when we think of the writer or the poet, he or she is up in their lonely garret waiting for inspiration to come in through the window. And here you were in this quite collaborative process, even though if the poems already existed, it there was much more of a sense of collaboration within it. What did that feel like for you? Because poetry, I guess, a lot of the time is a lonely old furrow.
Well, it was just wonderful, John. Wonderful to be working with the women. Wonderful to see their work. And even now, you know, the exhibition is on for 4 months. So I have a sense that we're working together through a really long stage, you know. So, yeah, it's been marvellous.
Well, listen, thanks so much for sharing the poems with us this evening and for giving us that extra insight into the exhibition. I think it opens up the exhibition possibly in new ways and might encourage some more people to get in and see it before it finishes up. Thanks for being with us, Jane.
Thanks, John. Thanks very much.
That's Jane Clark. And as I say, we'll continue now with two other exhibitions that Jess has been to see. Still within the Coach House Gallery in Dublin Castle. And again, textiles is the theme here. Obviously, they wanted to make some specific point, the curators here, in and around the idea of textiles as art as opposed to textiles as merely craft. And I'm giving out to myself for using the word merely there.
Yeah, I mean, it happens a lot. And actually, you often hear, you know, stories of how easily these types of works have been dismissed over time because of that association with you know, also unfairly deemed the lesser, you know, creativity or creative process of craft. And the one next door is called Beyond Chaos. And it is a smaller exhibition. The spaces are filled with a whole array, again, of different artists creating works through different versions of textile and different versions of making within that. And the mixture here is much more about the individual artist practice, so how they work alone. Yeah. We're sort of just talking about that. And then how they work in collaboration. And in particular, the artist groups grouped here, the Textile Journey Collective, they work a lot with outreach projects, with community projects. And some of the pieces in this exhibition are, you know, have come about from those type of projects.
Well, maybe I should specifically talk, first of all, about the piece that is called Textile Is Art by Dr. Nikki Collier. That's making the specific, the very point here, isn't it? Describe that image to us again, if you want to look at it, if you're listening, as you're listening, you can do so on at RTE Arena.
Yeah, so these are individual little triangles that have been made by different people. So some that are made by professional artists and some are made in these community groups or outreach or calls for submissions that were on Collier's website, for example. And then, as you know, each person works on their own and they can be very individual, from having, you know, stitched in writing or little symbols like hearts or very realistic looking little birds, different patterns, different techniques. And then they're all brought together in different arrangements. So the one that you're tweeting is a group of the triangles making a triangle that's then mounted on the wall. And they look like bunting, if people are trying to get a sort of visual image of them. And then in other cases, it's more of a structure where they're almost more like a pyramid on the ground made up of these. And then in other cases, it is more like a string of bunting. So the multiple ways that you can use individual artworks to come together to make a collective and kind of symbolizing individuals within communities.
A statement, I suppose, about what textiles are in general. Oftentimes, it's, you know, even if you think of the quilt or of other aspects of how textiles are made, it is often made up of panels or of pieces that come together to make something bigger.
Absolutely.
Talk to me a little bit then about Jane Fox's Dark Satanic Mills, which we'll tweet now at RTE Arena.
It's a very powerful one, and actually it shows you just how close to more traditional forms of painting artists can achieve.
Because in many ways it looks like a painting.
Absolutely.
in the reproduction, at least.
It really does, and even in person, although of course it has that extra texture which gives it something too. But in this case here, what we're looking at is a scene, very stylized, very almost evil looking chimneys on top of factories with this dark billowing smoke coming out. And the title of the work being Dark Satanic Mills comes from a poem by William Blake. And he's writing, you know, around 1806, and he's talking about this Industrial Revolution and how it is, you know, taking over the land and the kind of cruelty to the workers working in these situations. And in the poem, as well as in the artwork, there's a contrasting moment between the green land, which we see then in the background of Fox's work as well. And the thing I kind of was struck by this, and that we're being made more and more aware of, and actually both of these textile exhibitions talk about, is how sustainable materials are, and also ideas around recycling materials and of fast fashions. And that we think about these satanic mills of, you know, industry and production as being something from, you know, the 19th century. And yet this is where our cheap clothes come from today.
Just because we can't see it doesn't mean it's not happening.
Exactly.
All right. So those are the two exhibitions then, those two textiles based exhibitions running at the Coach House in Dublin Castle. You worked your way then from Dublin Castle down to the Quays and the Green and Red Gallery, where the work of Neil Yalter, is that how I say the name there, is on display. Internationally acclaimed artist and activist, Yalter's work deals with topics of exile, asylum and safe havens. This is quite a coup, I think, for the Green and Red to have Yalter exhibiting here.
Yeah, she's an extraordinary international artist with, you know, often very strong sense of sort of activism in her work as well. But I mean, she's in most, you know, major collections around the world. She's included in important temporary art, contemporary art exhibitions. She was given an award recently at the Venice Biennale. So this is a truly international, you know, an important important artist, and, you know, down in this one room gallery down on the quays. And it was a surprise to me in some respects seeing this work there.
Two very different pieces that we're going to tweet just to give a sense of her work. Square painting, first of all, which is anything but square, of course.
I did find that kind of funny,
rectangular. So maybe there's a little bit of irony at play here.
I think possibly.
But
I
also, I mean, the idea of, as people who are looking at the image, I mean, it's essentially one rectangular square, almost square, within another square, and quite two slightly different shades. This is not a new idea to give us a fairly straightforward shape in a painting.
Yeah, the really famous
Is she doing
example.
Something different here?
She is. So the really famous example is the black square by the suprematist artist from Russia, Malevich. And his idea to paint a black square on a white surface was, in a way, going back to the beginning, you know, wipe out everything that went before and start again. But in common with other abstract artists, he was thinking about how pure colour and pure shape can be an internationally, universally linking visual language. And I think that makes a lot of sense in relation to Nil Yalter, because her work has the same kind of instinct of wanting to bring people together and have that universality.
And one final piece that I'll tweet, Headless Body Belly Dance, very different. This is a still from a video, 23 minute long video. She has multiple nationalities, Cairo, Egypt, born there and moved to Turkey as a child. I suppose this is part of what's at play here in this video installation.
Yes, so she's the first Turkish female artist to work in video, and very much from a feminist slant, because she's taking control of the male gaze, reversing the male gaze by having us focus on her body but on her terms. And secondary to that, because she is has the Turkish connection and she's doing a sort of belly dance movement in this video, it's also a comment on that eroticizing of Middle Eastern women by the West too. So there's loads of those really interesting topics that are raised by
her. So this is an exhibition worth seeing.
Absolutely.
Particularly because she has such an international status, and great for the Green and Red Gallery.
And the topics are still relevant today, no matter when she made the work. Yeah.
Well, thanks for doing that, for visiting those exhibitions for us, Jess. Thanks also to Jane Clark, who was talking to us earlier. The two exhibitions at the Coach House in Dublin Castle, Roots, A Dialogue in Textile and Poetry, based on the work of Jane Clark, and Beyond Chaos, both run right over the Christmas period through until the 19th of January. And Nil Yalter is at the Green on Red Gallery until the end of January. The poet John Montagu was born in Brooklyn in 1929. 4 years later, his family hit hard times in New York when his uncle John died, and he was sent, the young Montagu that is, was sent back to aunts in his parents' native Tyrone. It was a rupture that marked him for life, all the more so when his mother returned to live nearby but did not claim him back. Of such hardships and more, poetry is made. John Montagu went on to live in America and France, as well as Ireland, as a highly respected writer and educator. He co-founded Clara Records with Garrick Brown, wrote plays and short stories and journalism, as well as poetry, and he's probably best known for The Rough Field, his collection from 1972. John Montagu, A Poet's Life, is a new biography by Adrian Fraser, a professor emeritus at the University of Galway and a lifelong friend of John Montagu. Mary O'Malley has been reading the book for us, and she joins me now from our Galway studio. I'll start, Mary, with that early life, which some people will be familiar and others mightn't be so familiar with. He wasn't the only child in the 1930s to be brought up by extended family rather than his own parents, obviously for practical reasons in many cases. Let's hear him tell what happened when his mother came back to Tyrone. And this is from an interview with Mike Murphy.
She came back to Ireland and she didn't claim me because, well, to give her the best motives. She probably saw that I was quite happy on the farm. I'd replaced my whole family, let's say my brothers and my mother and my father, I'd replaced them with a horde of animals. So I had horses and I had and I had cows and I had goats and I had dogs, lots of dogs. So I had, and children are extraordinary the way they survive. So I'd changed my allegiance, or I'd had to change my allegiance, and she probably felt that, but to give her the best motives, that this would be wrong to bring me back and to take me away from this, that I was on my own course. But clearly, it seemed to have upset me very much.
Yes. And where did she go to live when she came back?
Only 8 miles away, and I'd see her run about twice a year for very taut kind of family reunions.
And that's John Montague speaking to Mike Murphy. Yes. Early in about that experience early in his life. We're speaking tonight about the new biography of John Montague, John Montague, A Poet's Life. And as I say, Amir O'Malley has been reading it for us. One of the things that really strikes me, and I've heard that interview in full a couple of times, I've heard clips from it at different points along the way as well, it's how often, and I think it's there within the poems as well, Mary, how often he says something along the lines of to give her her best motives. It was something that marked him, but the way he treats it is quite interesting. Mm.
It is. That really stands out, doesn't it? Because once you say to give her best motives, the implication is that maybe there were others.
Yeah. Well, that is there. That is there for sure.
It's there. But he
manages to give her the best motives.
He does. And I think rightly, well, certainly the so-called abandonment, you know, the fact that he was sent home, you rightly said that this was not uncommon at all in the 1930s and later on indeed. I think the hurt was more from her, that she didn't claim him when she came back. Now, he was very happy with the wonderful aunts who reared him.
Yeah.
So he was very lucky in that way, and I think he's always acknowledged that. But there was a psychic wound.
And is it expressed in the poetry, that psychic wound, would you
absolutely.
Say?
Absolutely. I would say it's expressed almost from the get-go, particularly in the Rough Field. But in many, many other poems. And in the biography, Adrian Fraser talks a lot about that, not just in the early part of the biography, but it comes back again and again. That sense of dislocation, I think, stayed with him all his life.
He read as part of that interview with Mike Murphy, and it was a poem that he refused, in many, many occasions to read in public, and he wouldn't read all of it. This is the poem, The Locket, and the subject matter here is very obvious to us. And he says he was always afraid to read it because of how emotional an experience it was for him to read it. And I'm interested to listen to this poem, not just for its content here, but for his delivery of it and how much emotion is actually informing his delivery.
Yes.
Sing a last song for the lady who has gone. Fertile source of guilt and pain. The worst birth in the annals of Brooklyn. That was my cue to come on and my first claim into fame. And naturally, she longed for a girl, and all my infant curls are brown. Couldn't excuse my double blunder, coming out of both the wrong sex and the wrong way around. And so you never nursed me, and when all my father's songs couldn't sweeten the lack of money, when poverty comes through the door, love flies up the chimney, and your favourite saying, then you gave me away, and might never have known me if I'd not cycled down to court you like a young man, teasingly untying your apron, drinking by the fire, yarning of all your wild young days, which didn't last long. For you, lovely Molly, the belle of your small town, landed up mournful and chill as the constant rain that lashes it, wound into your cocoon of pain. Standing in that same hallway, don't come again, you say roughly, I start to get fond of you, John, and then you're up and gone, the harsh logic of a forlorn woman, resigned to being alone. And still, mysterious blessing, I never knew until you were gone that always round your neck you wore an oval locket with an old picture in it of a child in Brooklyn.
John Montague reading from his poem, The Locket. It doesn't matter how many times you hear that poem, Mary O'Malley,
really catches,
does it?
You, doesn't it? Yeah. And both the sense of his sense that he wasn't mothered is the first thing that strikes me. But also towards the end, his recognition that she did miss him.
Yeah, and that
image of the hair, her keeping the hair from the time when he was born in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And then you start to think of how difficult it must be for her to have sent those boys home, because there just wasn't enough money to keep them. It was during the Depression.
It is one of the tasks that Adrian Fraser has in this particular biography, not just in that early section, but later on too. John Montague was married three times. He speaks, I think he spoke to all three of the wives at some point the way, and recognises the type of guidance and how open and how helpful they were with him. He has to balance telling us what might be considered the biography of the person and what has that got to do with the poet, and still giving us the critical voice that talks about the poet as well. How has he done that, or how well has he done that?
I think that is an extraordinary, particularly when you include as much, let's say, personal detail as has been included in this biography. I think that is an enormous challenge. It's almost impossible to succeed well in because, first of all, we have to remember that Montagu had a very long writing life, and he had a very full personal life, much of which is documented. So the vast amount of material that this biographer had to deal with, it's greater than perhaps is usual, you know, because everything was documented. And one of the things that impressed me most about the biography was just the research alone was phenomenal. And as a source for future biographers or people who want to write about the Montagu's life or work or place certain poems in the context of what was happening in his life at certain times, it's absolutely... I don't see any... I mean, that's its main contribution, I believe.
Yeah, and
apart
I mean
from the life itself.
Yeah, the archive of John Montagu is extraordinary. We got that. Obviously, it was the locket is from the new collected poems published by the Gallery Press, originally from the 1984 collection, The Dead Kingdom. But that archive is a treasure trove for any scholar who wants to go finding out.
Absolutely extraordinary. I mean, much more complete than a lot of writers' archives. But that brings with it a challenge, and you just asked me about the balance. I think overall he's done quite a good job. There are times when the balance is probably inevitably out, because what do you choose and why do you choose to put in certain materials? You know, the occasion of a poem is quite different from what the poem may eventually turn out to be. For example, The Rough Field was written over a 12-year period.
Yeah, and that The Rough Field, I think, to a large extent, you would say it spans the entire biography in many ways here.
In many ways it does, because the dislocation that is obvious in Montagu in his work and in his life, in a sense, I knew him somewhat, and that was one of the first things I saw, that he didn't quite fit in or didn't see himself as fitting in.
Yeah.
And... you know, The Rough Field really traces that emotional break in certain ways.
Yeah, because he grew up in initially in New York. Then, as we heard that, coming back to Tyrone, and then went to UCD in the 1940s. How did he end up coming to UCD? Although there was a Republican background there in his father's life, and that in County Tyrone may have been problematic in the early years of the
and
Irish.
He got a scholarship. That was the other thing. I mean, he was apparently he was kind of going, thought to be a good candidate for the priesthood.
Well, he had been to a diocesan college, hadn't he, in Armagh?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I suppose it was normal that the scholarships and the quite a few of those people would have gone south, I would imagine.
What sort of Dublin do we get from Adrian Fraser for the 1940s and 50s?
As a woman, and I found it hard reading. I found it almost, I won't say toxic exactly, but, well, in ways it was. But this incredibly hard man sort of life among the writers, hard drinking, unpleasant to one another, competitive, edgy. I mean, you wouldn't want to be sensitive.
Yeah, and when you think of the sensitivity in the poem that we just heard, The Locket, and across many of Montagu's poems, that must have been a difficult place for him to be.
I imagine it was, honestly, I believe it was difficult for all men. Mm. I think one of the things that reading the book gave me a further insight into something I knew about on a certain level was how hard it was to be a man, forget being a woman. I mean, it didn't happen. In that particular world at the time, even though you had Edna O'Brien and Mary Lavin already published internationally. It was just a very male society and a very, I think, hard male society.
The book really takes off for you, this biography, Mary, I think, when Montagu goes to study in Iowa in 1954.
Yes.
Is partly because this is really where he had a chance to flourish as a poet, and maybe one could argue even as a person.
Yeah, well, partly it was the relief to get out of Dublin, the Dublin that had got into my head when I was reading about it. But also because he met Madeline, his first wife, there. And there is a sense in the biography where that was just such a source of sustenance and a steadying of his life, certainly for a while. Her love and her care and her also the she was French, and just that whole kind of connection that he already had with French writers or was beginning to have. But also then there was the extraordinary liberation of being in America at that time. The whole hippie thing was beginning to kick off for good and ill, and the anti-Vietnam protests and so on, which would happen when he got to Berkeley.
And he studied before he came back to work in Berkeley to teach there in the 1960s.
He had studied
previous to that with John Berryman and Allen Ginsberg.
I mean, he just was in America at an extraordinary time. And, with Lowell's influence was still very high at that time. And then there were all these generations of beat people and experimental poets and modernists, really. I mean, John was essentially a modernist as well as a lyricist. It's not a lyric poet. But he began to experiment with the line. And I think it's impossible to overestimate the importance of American that particular period and his reading on his own practice of poetry.
One aspect of the book that the Adrian Fraser's book that I would like you to touch on is because I feel that perhaps you wanted to hear more about the France period. I've skipped over it even in our chat, but he did spend time in France. I suppose all writers had to go to France at some point, didn't they?
They did, really. I think Tom McCarthy, a former student of his, Thomas McCarthy, said somewhere that I have it here. He said, "We've now forgotten how the charisma of France that pulled the Irish establishment into the European Union. And Montague belonged to an educated Irish generation of poets and diplomats who embodied that Francophile ideal." And he makes the point that Montague's treatment of love, history and politics in his poetry always had a kind of Parisian or Francophile edge and flavour. So I think while America might have formed a lot of his technical skills and technical approach to poetry, certainly, I think France perhaps formed a lot of his sensibility.
Who do you think this this biography is for, Mary? John Montague, A Poet's Life by Adrian Fraser.
Well, certainly for academics. Also for people who are very interested and perhaps very well read in Montague's work or familiar with his work, certainly.
Would newcomers get something from it?
They probably would, but I'm not sure it would be the first place I'd go, because the risk would be if they hadn't read much of Montague, it would be quite a difficult book to read, I think.
I was going to say, do you have a first place or a number of first places that you might send them?
I would. I'd sort of start with the collection A Chosen Light, and then I think The Rough Field, probably.
Mm. Yeah, so go to the poetry first, and then if you want to come to
What I would do. Yeah.
You're going to finish with a selection or a small section of one of John's poems for us, I believe, Mary?
Yes, please.
What are you reading from?
I'm reading from The Rough Field, and I'm reading from the section that's the Patriotic Suite, I think, is it? Patriotic Suite. It was dedicated to Sean O'Riordan. And a couple of stanzas, section six, and I'll read the last three short stanzas from that. Here nothing has been planned, assembled, yes, casual, and coarse as detritus, affronting eye and mind. Only a drift of smoke and the ant-like activity of cars indicate life, with the wild flap of laundry in 1,000 backyards. Soon we are running through summer fields where a roller is at work, bruising neat stripes of corn under hawthorn edges, patterned in white flame.
That's Mary O'Malley reading the poetry of John Montagu from the Rough Field. Mary, thanks for sharing your thoughts
thanks
with
very
us
much,
this evening.
Sean.
Mary speaking to us about John Montagu, A Poet's Life by Adrian Fraser, which is published by Lilliput Press. Years ago this month, the classic detective mystery Chinatown opened in Irish cinemas. Los Angeles, set in 1930s Los Angeles, it starred Jack Nicholson as Private Eye Jake Githes, hired by high society Evelyn Mulraw, played by Faye Dunaway, to find out if her husband was having an affair. Strong reviews and a good box office business led to 11 Oscar nominations, including Best Picture, Best Director, Actor, Actress, Cinematography, Score, and Director, as I said. Roman Polanski, who was, of course, subsequently shunned by Hollywood, having faced sexual charges against a minor. He remains a fugitive in France. Tonight, however, as we remember the film Chinatown, we will concentrate on the Oscar that it did win at the time, Best Original Screenplay. With us to talk about the film is Stephen Benedict. First of all, let's remind ourselves of some of the film's great lines.
Since you agree with me that we've never met before, you must also agree with me that I've never hired you to do anything, certainly not spy on my husband. I see you like publicity, Mr. Giddes. Well, you're going to get it.
What do you think? Evelyn Mulray knocked off her husband in the ocean, then dragged him up to a reservoir because she thought it would look more like an accident? Mulray was murdered and moved because somebody didn't want his body found in the ocean.
See, Mr. Gitz, most people never have to face the fact. At the right time and the right place, they're capable of anything.
Isn't this something? Middle of a drought and the water commissioner drowns. Only in L.A.
Either you bring the water to L.A., or you bring L.A. to the water.
Yeah, bad for the glass.
Oh, yes. Bad for glass. Salt water, very bad for glass.
Who is she? And don't give me that crap about your sister because you don't have a sister.
I'll tell you the truth.
Good. What's her name?
Catherine.
Catherine who?
She's my daughter.
There you go. That is Faye Dunaway at the end there of that selection from Chinatown. We also heard the voices of Jack Nicholson and John Huston in the midst of that, Stephen, and the others essentially bit players.
Yeah.
But it gives us some sense of the great dialogue within there. So let's start with Robert Towne, who was the screenwriter here.
Yeah.
He emerged in the late 1960s as a scream doctor.
Yeah.
Bonnie and Clyde.
That's right.
Put the plasters on that. The Godfather?
He did. He
wrote Parallax View?
Yeah.
So was Chinatown, did people go, God, he made a great job on those three. Let's just give him his own movie.
Well, what happened was he originally wanted to be an actor and he was actually studying in the same acting class as Jack Nicholson. And then he realised, I'm not going to cut it as an actor. And he went off to be a writer. And as you said, he began as a script doctor.
Mm.
And on the strength of the work of Bonnie and Clyde and The Godfather, Robert Evans, who was the then head of Paramount Pictures, went to him and said, look, I'd like you to adapt The Great Gatsby. And here's a huge paycheck for you to do it. And Robert Towne turned him down and he said, no, I'm developing a story which is very, very complex, but it's about the origins of Los Angeles and it's a detective story. And I'm writing it with Jack Nicholson in mind. And Evans went, grand, that's a great idea. I'll give you a small check to develop that story. So that's how Chinatown began.
Yeah, let's hear Towne himself talking about the origins of the story then and what inspired him to write it in the first place.
All my early childhood memories of L.A., just the sights, the sounds and the smells, were something that drew me to that project. There'd been an article in the old This Week magazine in the L.A. Times, and it was a piece called Raymond Chandler's L.A. And in it there were photographs that had been taken in 1970, but done as if they were taken in 1930s. I said, you know, you could still recapture the L.A. that I vaguely remembered. And I was in a battle with a building developer who was trying to destroy Benedict Canyon. And I got to see the exquisite corruption in City Hall ramming this thing through and felt a great sense of loss of everything that was passing.
exquisite corruption. Robert Towne there, the screenwriter of Chinatown, which 50 years old this month, Stephen Bendix speaking to us about it this evening. One of the things that strikes me, even as when he's talking about it there, it has lots of the themes that you might associate with film noir. And I know you were saying to me as we were listening, your great contention is that it's not quite noir.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you think, even as we listen, think of that clip that we just heard, the slowness of the delivery, it doesn't have that pitter-patter that we'd expect. But that, you know, drawly trumpet music in the background really creates a noir feel to it as well, doesn't it?
That's true. And the interesting thing is, you know, we have movies which are plot-driven and we have movies which are character driven, but Chinatown was conceived as an idea. It was really theme driven at the beginning. And Towne wanted to write a story about Los Angeles, the idea of Los Angeles and how it came about. As he says, the corruption, right? The history, the beauty, and the criminal acts that now stand at its foundation. So for Robert Towne, as far as he was concerned, he grew up in Los Angeles. His father was a real estate agent. And Los Angeles isn't just a city on a map, it's a state of mind. And that's really what
describe the state of mind, whatever Towne thinks is the state of mind of Los Angeles.
It's a sense of loss, okay? The past is gone, our dreams are torn, innocence is corrupted, and the environment is damaged. Towne initially conceived of Chinatown as a trilogy. He wanted to write three different scripts, three different plots. One would be to chart the development and the decay of Los Angeles. The first one would be around water. The second one would be around oil. And the third one would be around pollution. The idea was in each story, there'd be a crime committed, which is so great, you can actually get away with it.
And did he give us the trilogy eventually?
There was a sequel called The Two Jakes, which was released in 1990, which unfortunately is better forgotten.
Yeah, just so therefore when the sequel didn't, when part two of the trilogy didn't work, part three never came in to being. All right, talk to us then about Chinatown as a great classic detective story, because that's kind of how it started out, isn't it?
That's it. I mean, you know, people say it's a part of the film noir genre. I just want to correct everyone there. Firstly, film noir is not a genre. It's a style, it's a mood, it's a look, noir. And the reason why it's mistaken for a genre is because it is so closely linked to the detective genre, which reached its zenith in Hollywood in the 1940s and 50s, which coincides with the noir cycle in the 40s and 50s. But really, you know, I would say that noir in Chinatown isn't noir because visually it's very, very bright. It's not a dark picture. It's very, most of it, almost all of the story unfolds under the baking sun of Southern California. And it misses another central component in film noir, which is the femme fatale. Evelyn Mulray is not a femme fatale. Okay,
this is the Faye Dunaway character.
Yes, the Faye Dunaway character. But without a doubt, what Robert Towne wrote is an incredibly nuanced, beautifully layered story, which, as we said, is arguably the most influential screenplay ever to come out of Hollywood.
Let's have a listen then to, seeing as you're talking about that detective genre genre there, let's hear Robert Towne again, this time talking about how people like Raymond Chandler portrayed their detectives and as noble, incorruptible men who always went out no matter what. He had different ideas, I think.
I mean, most detective movies had been about exotic falcons, about heists, jewels, weird crimes of one kind or another. Water and power? That was unusual.
The characters in the film, I tried to draw from life, not from film. I mean, starting with the Philip Marlowe prototype of Gittes. I mean, Philip Marlowe in Dashiell Hammett movies was always, you know, the tarnished knight.
So there you go. That's Robert Towne. Clearly not enamoured of the idea of the tarnished knight in detective fiction. So what does he give us, Stephen, in Stephen Bendix with us? Jake Geddes, his character played by Jack Nicholson.
Yeah, well, I don't want to give away the ending, but the important thing to note is because this is in the 1970s, there's a lot of revisionism of the classic golden age of Hollywood. The movie, Jack Nicholson's character, Jake Geddes, doesn't succeed. He solves the crime, but it's useless him solving the crime, who committed the crime, because it amounts to nothing. The crime is so great that the criminal gets away with it. And the thing about one of the reasons why Chinatown is so revered is not necessarily exclusively because it's such a brilliantly written screenplay and it's so nuanced and layered in its themes and everything. A lot of its reputation relies on the fact that in the last 50 years, there's been enormous growth in screenwriting as an academic pursuit and academic modules in colleges across the world. And the reason why Chinatown is so revered is because it's one of the favorite teaching tools of lecturers. There's a guy in Los Angeles in the 1970s, a guy called Sid Field. He was a professor of screenwriting. Mm. And he wrote a book called Screenplay. And in that book, he said Chinatown presents the paradigm for perfect structure in a story. And he contended that structure is the most important thing in a screenplay. I respect Sid Field's authorship and intelligence, but I vehemently disagree with him to say that structure is the most important thing. I'll ask you, Sean, when's the last time that you came out of a movie?
Great structure in that film.
Great structure. You're not building a bridge. You're telling a story, and a story is all about emotion and bringing the characters to the emotions, because drama is about emotional transitions.
So in terms of Chinatown and what has made it last then and made that screenplay be so revered if for different reasons and spoken about in different ways, is it better than Casablanca? Is it better than The Godfather? Which of your children do you love most?
Yeah, I think that's the fair thing. It depends what you're looking for in a story. If you're looking for romance and you're looking for drama and a little bit of comedy, you're looking to go for you're looking for Casablanca. If you're looking for, I think, a very, very original take on one of the oldest detective stories in the world, Oedipus Rex, Chinatown is going to be your cup of tea. But if you're looking for something that is a searing document about gangsterhood and America and capitalism, The Godfather is going to be the one. So it really is mix, you know, six of one and half a dozen of the other. But without a doubt, Chinatown is a superbly written story, brilliantly realized characters. And I think the movie marks the zenith for many of the people involved, not least of whom was Jerry Goldsmith. You're talking about the music. The score was written, composed and conducted and mixed in all in 9 days. The whole thing.
It is kind of extraordinary, but it has a real feel. You almost feel that trumpet is part, somebody's playing it in the background.
That's right.
As the film is happening.
Yeah, and it adds to the melancholia of the story. And I think the one thing that the movie resembles more than noir is Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo, because Vertigo has the same melancholic tone, and it's about a man who makes a mistake twice, and that mistake results in the destruction of a woman.
So when you say that this isn't film noir, you're touching on what Chinatown is then. Do you have a word for it? Is it a genre?
I think it's a tragedy.
Old-fashioned tragedy.
Yeah, well, no, if your audience haven't seen it, I don't want to ruin it for them. But once they see the end of the film, they'll see that it's a tragedy that borders on a horror film, because the crime that is committed is going to be committed again upon other people, and the criminal will get away with it and nothing will change.
In terms of the performances here, you're very clear that Faye Dunaway's character, Evan Murray, is not the femme fatale.
No.
How important is her acting within this?
Well, it's quite remarkable. I think she gave an even greater performance 2 years later in Network, for which she won her Oscar. But she's quite brilliant as a very, very high society lady who is doing her utmost to protect the most innocent person in the film. And if you think about it, you know, Nicholson's character, Jay Kitties, is different from the shining knight of Raymond Chandler's noir universe.
Yeah.
But Nicholson is a little bit tarnished himself, a little bit corrupt. He will bend the rules. And so Faye Dunaway is the only character within the entire cast that is truly virtuous. And because the city is so corrupt, she then, I don't want to destroy the end of it, something happens. And the thing is, you see that her character is the embodiment of the city itself. She's representative of Los Angeles and the corruption and the loss of innocence, and everything is gone and everything is ruined.
And given that Robert Towne possibly gave up acting because Jack Nicholson was in his acting class, and that this was written for Jack Nicholson, how important is he to the film?
Really much so. Very, very important, because Nicholson, you know, was part of the counterculture identity in the late 60s and 70s. And only Nicholson, the actor, could have bought off this sneering attempt to take on the establishment and fail. If you had think of Robert Redford,
he'd have to win.
Yeah, Redford would have to win. Warren Beatty would have to win. But Nicholson is the only, there's something dark. Yeah. There's a darkness at the center of Nicholson's persona on screen.
Stephen Bendick talking to us about Chinatown, 50 years on, available about now on remastered 4K and Blu-ray. And that's our lot for this Wednesday evening. Paula Shields researched, Ollie Hamilton was broadcast coordinator, on Jamie Doyle was on sound here in Dublin, and John Doyle on sound in Galway earlier on for us. Tonight's programme was produced by Pauline McNamara. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RTE Radio 1. And John Creedon will be with you after the news.